You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, deserved or absurd? Mixed reactions as the Nobel Committee announces the winner of this year's Peace Prize.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2012 is to be awarded to the European Union.
And a cyber Pearl Harbor. The US Defense Secretary issues a dire warning about the damage a hostile power could inflict on the United States. But we ask, who is willing and able to orchestrate such an attack? Plus, Australia's national bird, could it be about to become India's national dish?
The test is between chicken and beef. It's a very interesting meat, very low in cholesterol. It's not a greasy meat at all.
I'll also be sitting down with the editor of the Bookseller magazine to find out why six-figure advances are becoming more rare in the literary world. All that and some great music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So an action-packed hour here on Monocle 24, but before we get started, let's get the world news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The European Union has been awarded the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize for its long-term role in uniting the continent. The award is being seen as a morale boost for the bloc as it struggles to resolve its debt crisis. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso expressed his joy at the announcement.
I think this is an encouragement. I see this Nobel Peace Prize not only as a recognition for what is achieved, but also as increased responsibility for all of us in the European Union. Not only the European institutions, but also the governments of Europe. So I hope that this gives this sense of responsibility to agree on some steps that are necessary, namely to address the crisis of the euro, or the crisis in the euro area to be more exact.
However, traders at a bustling central London market were scornful of the European Union being awarded such a prize.
It's a bit vague, it's difficult to identify with, but when you see it the positive way, you could hope that countries cooperating for peace is a good cause, of course. But for everybody, it's an institution, and that's difficult to identify with.
The International Monetary Fund head Christine Lagarde has backed calls for Greece to have more time to meet the targets of its bailout. Ms. Lagarde told correspondents that this might be better than front-loading heavily. However, Germany, who has contributed the most to Greece's bailouts, opposed any extensions. Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble said he believed arrangements should stay as agreed. In other developments, the IMF has lowered its expectations of Japan's economic growth in 2012 and 13, saying a shrink of overseas demands and deflation will weigh on the world's third largest economy. The Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk has announced a big programme of investment aimed at reviving the economy and shoring up support from voters. Mr. Tusk said he would find billions of euros for investment in energy and other infrastructure projects, while at the same time keeping a tight rein on government borrowing in Poland. Turkey has scrambled two fighter planes to the border after a Syrian military helicopter bombed the border town of Azmarin, according to a witness report. Reuters footage shows a military helicopter flying over Azmarin, which is in Syria, and dropping explosives. Lithuania will hold a non-binding referendum on the government's planned new nuclear power plant on Sunday, on the same day as a parliamentary election, in a move that could boost support for the opposition and derail the project with a big vote against it. Parliament's decision to hold the vote puts energy issues at the centre of the election, with the opposition and government split on how to reduce the country's energy dependence on Russia. A new exhibition marking the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis has opened in Washington. The exhibition features clandestine real-time White House recordings from President Kennedy's meetings with his advisers, secret correspondence between Khrushchev and Kennedy, and CIA-prepared personality studies of the Soviet leader and Cuba's Castro. Curator Stacey Bredhoff explained the background.
The missile crisis was really the most dangerous moment in history. It was the closest the world ever came to a nuclear war. There was intense debate among his advisors, the president and his advisors, how best to respond. But everybody agreed that those missiles could not be tolerated.
And the exhibit located at the National Archives building is due to run through to the 3rd of February. That's the news here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. It's 5 minutes past six in the evening here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, de London, this is Monocle 24.
Ut London, vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda. London,
cara. London으로부터.
From London.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, from a continent of wars to a continent of peace. Those are the words of the chairman of the Nobel Committee speaking in Oslo earlier today about the reasoning behind the decision to award the European Union this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Well, today's announcement comes as a huge morale boost for a bloc that's embroiled in financial turmoil. But many are asking if this award, at this moment, is appropriate. Indeed, some have gone as far as to brand it an absurd decision. But, say those in favour of the decision, let's not forget this bloc has been working to promote peace, democracy and human rights ever since the 1957 Treaty of Rome. Well, to tell us more, we're joined now by Christian Berg-Harpviken, who is the director of PRIO. That's the Peace Research Institute of Oslo, which is an independent research institution. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Monocle. Now, do you think this is due recognition for the EU? After all, it's brought about a record stretch of peace for Europe, and it also arguably helped end the Cold War.
I think the prize to the EU is very well argued by the committee. Its justification is sound and points to the EU as historically a peace project, and at that a peace project which has contributed enormously to stability on the European continent.
But in terms of the timing, there are those who are saying that perhaps the Nobel Committee has spoken a little bit too soon, given that the single currency has actually been sparking violence in Athens and Madrid. That's just two cities in the past week alone.
Well, I'm not sure whether it's speaking too soon or too late. I'm certainly puzzled by the fact that the EU was awarded the prize exactly in 2012, which is probably the year where the EU is undergoing the most severe crisis in recent times. And it is striking that the committee, in its justification for the prize, points to the history, points to the current expansion to several countries or negotiations with countries in the Balkans, but does not at all mention the capacity of the EU to tackle the current crisis. And of course, given that the prize is awarded now, you would have expected a commentary on the current crisis management of the EU.
And Christian, do you think perhaps there were some more deserving candidates perhaps out there than the EU?
Well, I certainly had my own favourites. I had a list of five candidates out, and I think several of them would be definitely more deserving this year than the EU. And that's not because I'm belittling the importance of the EU, rather the opposite. But in 2012, given the emphasis in Alfred Nobel's will that the prize should be going to the person that has contributed the most to peace in the recent year, I did not see the EU as the strongest candidate, by no means.
Would you be willing to share with us perhaps some of your scribblings and your notes that you've been taking as to who was on your list of perhaps more deserving candidates?
Absolutely, and I would expect some of them to be on favorite lists also in the future. My top candidate this year was Gene Sharp, an American analyst of nonviolence, who has contributed a virtual toolbox of nonviolent techniques and been enormously influential in nonviolent protests across the world for several decades. Widely read, for example, during the nonviolent protests of the Arab Spring in Tahrir Square and beyond. And I think as a nod to the Arab Spring, where perhaps a prize to civil society activists is would have been less well placed this year than it was last year, summing it all up by underlining the importance of nonviolent protest and the enormous impact that nonviolent protest can have, I think Jean Sharp would have been a very, very well-placed candidate.
Mm. And so it sounds to me as though you're saying as well that given the context of today and with the Arab Spring as a backdrop, there's been quite a missed opportunity here, perhaps, if indeed this is all about giving a morale boost.
Well, I think, to be honest, that the price to the EU is very much a price that is seen as a compensation for the historic neglect of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee of the EU. So this is basically rectifying that neglect more than anything else. And I do think that is problematic, not because I disagree with the worthiness of the EU, but simply because it communicates so badly in the exact political situation in which the EU finds itself at the moment.
Well, were there any other runners-up on your list? I mean, was there anyone perhaps from Russia where, let's face it, it's a country where freedom of speech seems to be slightly on a reversing trend?
Absolutely, and I thought Russia would be a very likely place to look for Nobel Peace Prize candidates this year and scrutinize the field quite carefully. And on my list I had a couple of Russian candidates. One was the organization Memorial alongside one of its key members, Svetlana Ganushkina, organization devoted to documenting human rights abuses and repression both historically and today, an enormously impressive organization. I also had a Russian radio station, radio, TV and website, in fact, Radio Echo Moscow, which is an independent radio channel operating since 1990 and which has also serves as a source of credible information for everybody who is interested in taking a more overall look at what the political developments within Russia and its immediate neighborhood is.
All right, well, it sounds to me as though you're saying that the European Union is a deserving candidate, but perhaps 2012 wasn't the year that perhaps the EU should have been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Thank you very much indeed, Christian Berg-Hartvigen, the director of PRIO Peace Research Institute in Oslo. Thank you for speaking to Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. It is 6:15 in the evening here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. The US Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has issued a dire warning for what he's calling a potential cyber Pearl Harbor. In his warning, Panetta said that foreign hackers could, and I quote, paralyze and shock the US and create a profound new sense of vulnerability. Well, the examples he gave were the possible derailment of passenger trains or the contamination of U.S. water supplies or even the shutting down of the national grid. Well, to tell us more, we're joined now on the line from Washington by Arnaud de Borgrave. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us. You're the director and senior advisor for the Transnational Threats Project at the CSIS, which is the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Some rather alarmist language there from Panetta, comparing cyber attacks to, I don't know, 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. Is the threat really on that scale?
Much so, and we've been warning about it for the last 15 years. Matter of fact, I was the editor of a publication called Cybercrime, Cyberterrorism, and Cyberwarfare, averting an electronic Waterloo, and we chose Waterloo rather than Pearl Harbor because the impact was a little longer lasting. The Soviets were already very big on this before the collapse of the Soviet Union, and their equivalent of the National Security Agency in Washington is called FAPSI, and they've been heavily involved in cyber warfare ever since. You may recall several years ago that they managed to take Estonia, isolate Estonia completely. They cut them off from the rest of the world. That was just the early beginnings of cyber warfare.
Mm. And it's also, of course, made the subject of films and books. So it's nothing new. Why is Leon Panetta coming out with this right now?
Well, because of presumably because of the attacks that were launched against Iran, electronic attacks were launched against Iran to try to discombobulate their nuclear program, which was basically an act of cyber war. And I think since then they've taken cognizance of the fact that it's a two-way street.
And they're presumably thinking that Iran, it's just a question of when rather than if it will retaliate.
Absolutely. We gave the example of young school-age boys who managed to take five U.S. Air Force bases out of any contact with the Pentagon, and that was 15 years ago. Things have gotten dramatically worse since then.
Apart from Iran, which foreign powers have A, the capability, and B, the desire to attack the United States in that way?
Well, you wouldn't know who is attacking you to begin with. If it's properly done, there's no way of really, you can assume who's been doing it, but you don't know for a fact, since these things can be launched from different parts of the world. But China's certainly in a very advanced stage of developing cyber warfare. So is Russia, France, and then, of course, some of the smaller powers are also very active in the field, working towards the day when a smaller power can bring a superpower to its knees.
Mm. And you're mentioning there that it's difficult to trace, but don't some cyber attacks have hallmarks that you can then trace back to their source to some extent?
And if you're lucky, you can. I can tell you two examples recently that came to my attention when I was chairing a conference at CSIS on this very subject. And the cybernaut from the Pentagon was there, and the cybernaut from Goldman Sachs. The Pentagon general said that they'd been attacked 6 million times in one day. Those are attempted intrusions. We were not told which ones were successful, but we do know for a fact from other sources that the internal communication system of the Pentagon was once knocked out for 48 hours.
Hmm. It's almost as though the United States is the number one target, if you like, because it is the largest economy in the world. And as you say, the idea of bringing a superpower to its knees, especially if you're not a superpower yourself, it's somewhat ironic. But do you think that in some way Leon Panetta has perhaps invited such an attack or an attack on that scale by making this very alarming declaration?
Well, it's no more alarming than some of the things we've been hearing for the last several years at CSIS. So I think it's finally reached his degree of consciousness, but it certainly had reached ours many, many years ago.
But we can assume, can't we, that as well as telling us that there is a problem, Leon Panetta and his people are working on finding solutions. In other words, doing more to safeguard American systems, especially the vital systems.
Yes, that's been going on for some time, quite apart from what he's been up to. What Panetta's been up to, you had the National Security Agency that is now a dual command with the Cyber Command, which was only stood up 2 years ago. And they've been very active in trying to protect us from cyber attacks, but they're a long way from having succeeded.
But Garner, it seems to me, especially the examples that were given, contamination of water supplies, the derailment of passenger trains, can't more to be done to ring-fence national interests like those, really important bits of infrastructure, and perhaps detach them some way from any broader network or the internet?
That will obviously take time. Cyber war, clearly, the Pentagon believes it has a cyber wall around the Defense Department. But if you could be, attacked 6 million times in one day, obviously the defenses are not what you expect them to be and probably won't be for a long time to come.
All right. Thank you very much indeed, Arnaud de Beaugrave, the director and senior advisor of the Transnational Threats Project at the CSIS. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Burgess Watson. Now, when we think of Frankfurt, we tend to think of finance. And when you say Frankfurt and deal in the same sentence, you'd automatically think deals being struck between traders and investment bankers. Well, think again. Six-figure deals are currently under discussion there in Germany's financial hub. And these are book deals. And they're being struck on the sidelines of the Frankfurt Book Fair, which is now underway. So how are these deals structured? And are the rules of the book publishing game changing? Well, to tell us, I'm joined here in the studio by Philip Jones, who's the editor of the Bookseller magazine. Hi there, Philip, and thank you for coming in to see us. Tell us a little bit about how publishers pay advances to established authors and debut authors. How does it work?
Well, usually there's a middleman involved known as the literary agent, and he or she is the person who is really most in charge of getting the auction together, getting the submissions out to publishers, and then getting the auction sort of built up. So you'll get a number of publishers bidding on the book, rather like buying a house, I guess. You take a look at it, you decide what it's worth to you, and then you double it and then you bid. And sometimes you'll get publishers coming in with what's called a preempt, in which case they'll try and wipe everybody off the floor and try and take the book because they've got a particularly good angle on it. Mostly agents will try and get the highest deal for their author. Now, there's two components to that deal. One is the royalty rate, which is the amount you earn per book sold, whether that's an ebook or a print book. The other part is the advance. Now, some publishers will pay a large advance and a lower royalty rate. Some publishers will try and pay a smaller advance and a higher royalty rate. It depends on what they think of the book.
So as a debut author, obviously, you'd want a higher advance as possible. And perhaps you would think, you know, the royalties would be secondary, because of course, you know, you're someone who hasn't written anything before, and that advance is going to be extremely attractive.
Well, the advance system works very well for debut authors because it gives them that money and that leeway to give up their work or to put their work to the side for a little while and concentrate on the book. So it works well for publishers and also for the reader, because then a publisher can work with an author to really develop a book and get a better book out of the process. So the book they see when they make the initial bid, the initial advance or the initial deal, isn't necessarily the book that comes out, you know, a year later. So the advance works very well in that sort of traditional sense.
But ironically, the biggest advances don't go to the debut authors or the lesser known authors. They go to the very established brands, let's say, in the book writing world, the people who arguably need the money the least.
Yeah, that's becoming increasingly the case. I mean, as the publishing world becomes increasingly digital, the advance market, the way it's set up, is going to change, because in the old world, you could pay a high advance, you could expect to get some of that back either through rights deals or through booksellers getting in copies of the book early, and the money sort of revolves around the system. In the ebook world, the publisher doesn't get any of that money back till the book starts selling, which means the risk they take is all the greater. If the book flops, then they're screwed, they'll never get the advance back. So the way it's going is they're working harder with their big brands because they at least know there's a guaranteed return and they will get the advances, whereas debut authors, ironically, even though they need it more, as you say, are struggling to get kind of big advances now.
Digital books and e-books, as they're known, have they done to the book industry, the literary industry, what, let's say, online music and streaming has done to the music industry?
Not yet. There's a lot of talk about streaming, a lot of fascinating industry discussion, thinking about Spotify and how it might work for books. It hasn't come yet, and I'm not sure it will come in quite the same way. Digital books have come, but they've come legally, unlike the music industry, which obviously had a huge problem with piracy and Napster. So there is a legal marketplace for selling books. So publishers are making money out of digital sales, and that's great. It is changing the financial model, but that's a sort of side issue because it's going to happen anyway, and at least there is money coming through. It's not working too well for booksellers, who are now being negated from that system, with people buying direct from Amazon or direct on their Kindle or Sony e-reader devices. But the money is at least still circulating around the system, albeit in different ways.
What sort of sums of money, going back to these advances, are people typically getting? Obviously, some sums hit the headlines because they're colossal, they're eye-watering amounts of money. What would be a more typical example of an advance you might hope to shoot for if you were an up-and-coming author?
A debut author, I think you'd be struggling to get any kind of advance now. Certainly, probably the most you'd hope for is a five-figure advance, and that might be stretched over two books, maybe even three books. Obviously, if you've got we see some startling deals for debut authors or self-published writers where they've got an established community. So publishers are looking for a kind of guaranteed market. So if you've got a blog, you have a million viewers on it or a million followers on your Twitter stream or whatever, you're going to get a higher advance because publishers can see the marketing potential there. If you're an unknown debut, you've never written a book before, no one really knows you, well, agents tell us they're really struggling to sell those, to get that investment. If you were a big brand name, we just reported a deal today in the bookseller for Simon Sebag Montefiore for a history book, and he's got a million euro advance for that book. Now, that's not unusual, because that will probably be a TV deal as well. They'll probably sell rights all over the world. The book is ironically called The World of History, so it really is a big global book. So that sort of deal makes sense, even though it is still quite eye-watering.
Mm. And he, as a young, up-and-coming author, would probably concur. He probably needs the money much less than they do.
Mm. But the way the deal is structured, he won't get that money up front. He'll get it in tranches, depending on when he delivers the book. And by the time the book comes out, the publisher will probably have recovered at least half of that through rights deals, or through TV deals, or through other kind of, you know, subsidiary deals, basically, that they will do, having bought world rights. So it's... that kind of risk is going to be mitigated by lots of other things a publisher will do around that book.
Do you think literary agents and publishers are looking at a book in isolation for what it's worth nowadays? Or do you think they're always thinking 2-3 steps ahead? Will it make a TV series? Will there be a part 2, 3, 4, 5 ad infinitum? Do you think that if you've just got a standalone book, you stand as much of a chance as someone who perhaps has got, you know, whole brand that they can roll out as a result of that book and spin off?
Yeah, it's a good question. As publishers' ability to rely on the big book chains like Waterstones and the supermarkets like Sainsbury's and Asda to get those books into stores and display them, which is still the main driver of book sales, as publishers can no longer rely on those in the same way, I think they are having to look beyond the book when they make the deal. So I imagine with the Sebag Montefiore book, they'll be thinking about the app rights, the ebook rights, the TV rights, as they come up with that deal. And I think that's why that figure is so big. So they're increasingly looking for brands, and brands that can be developed across media. And I think that's absolutely right.
All right, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Philip Jones, editor of The Bookseller magazine. You're listening to Midori House. Do stay tuned.
This is Monocle 24.
Vi escutate Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Essa är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 podcast, ja.
Monocle 24 är jag också.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Bropa Jalavet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's exactly 6:30 in the evening here in London. In the next 30 minutes of the programme, I'll be speaking to the author of The Silk Road, Valerie Hansen. We'll also be taking a stroll around the neighbourhood to meet some of our Marylebone neighbours.
We've given the opportunity to artists come in here and respond to the building, add to it, transform it, and the results are very interesting.
So all of that to look forward to in the next 30 minutes. But first, here's James Luckhurst with a wrap of the world news.
The European Union has been awarded the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize for its long-term role in uniting the continent. The award is being seen as a morale boost for the bloc as it struggles to resolve its debt crisis. The International Monetary Fund head Christine Lagarde has backed calls for Greece to have more time to meet the targets of its bailout. Ms. Lagarde told correspondents that this might be better than front-loading heavily or making Greece pay the most up front. However, Germany, who has contributed the most to Greece's bailouts, opposed any extensions. In other developments, the IMF has lowered its expectation of Japan's economic growth in 2012 and 13, saying a shrink of overseas demands and deflation will weigh on the world's third largest economy. The Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk has announced a big programme of investment aimed at reviving the economy and shoring up support from voters. Mr. Tusk said he would find billions of euros for investment in energy and other infrastructure projects. Lithuania will hold a non-binding referendum on the government's planned new nuclear power plant on Sunday, on the same day as a parliamentary election, in a move that could boost support for the opposition and derail the project with a big vote against it. And a new exhibition marking the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis has opened in Washington. The exhibition features clandestine real-time White House recordings from President Kennedy's meetings with his advisers, as well as secret correspondence between him and Khrushchev. And that's the news here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London. I'm Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, when I think of the Silk Road, I tend to conjure up romantic images of caravans of camels carrying a cargo of spices, precious stones, and obviously silk, as the name implies. Well, for centuries, the route had been linking great civilizations of China, India, Persia, Europe, and Arabia. But just how accurate is my rather unoriginal vignette of this vast 6,500-kilometer trade highway? Well, to tell us, we're joined on the line by Valerie Hansen, who's a professor of history at Yale University and the author of The Silk Road, which has just been published in hardback. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us, Professor. Have I painted a rather unfair and clearly not very original image of the Silk Road?
It's not unfair. It's just that the evidence that we have, much of which was preserved in the sands of by the dry climate, gives us a very different picture of people moving on the Silk Road, but not very often for the purposes of trade. And if people were moving for trade, often it was only over a small distance with just a few pack animals.
What sort of things have you discovered in researching your new book, The Silk Road?
That many of the people who are moving along the Silk Road are refugees, and they're fleeing. This is the period between 500 and 800, as there's a lot of contact between China and Iran, and many people are leaving Iran because it's the period of the Islamic conquest, and they come to China and settle and do all kinds of things, farming the land, being soldiers, being a veterinarian. So, and we have letters sometimes that people write. One woman is stranded by her husband, and she writes very angrily that he, you know, isn't coming to collect her, and is quite angry with him, and has to wait for a caravan to come. So, and she has to wait for a friend to give her money before she's able to leave.
Well, presumably, quite a lot of people did get lost on that vast stretch of road, and presumably there were sort of highwaymen and other people, so people didn't always make it to their destination.
Right. Everyone talks about walking along routes and seeing human remains on the side of the road.
Terrifying. What sort of language did people communicate? And how would an Iranian tradesman, a Persian tradesman, and someone from China communicate?
Well, there were a lot of bilingual and trilingual people growing up in Central Asia. The Iranians spoke a language called Sogdian, which was used in the area around modern-day Samarkand, which is in Uzbekistan, and the Chinese were speaking Chinese. So there were bilingual people. Later on, Tibetan becomes an important language that people use. Sanskrit, inside the monasteries, people are speaking Sanskrit with each other. So there are many different languages. There are languages people have often not heard of, like Kuchayan and Ugnian, that were spoken at the time.
And was it a perfectly balanced trading relationship, or was it slightly skewed one way or the other in terms of the flow of goods and traffic?
Well, I think more people were coming into China than going out of it, simply because China was kind of a safe haven for people at the time. We don't know. We don't have any kind of statistics about the flow of trade. Sorry, I don't know the answer to that. We know a lot of things. I mean, we know some important things come into China, like glass comes into China from Central Asia, and we know important things leave China. Everyone has heard of silk, but silk is not very important to our modern lives. Paper was discovered in China and then moves from China into Iran and from there to Europe. And that, of course, is an invention that has a huge impact on all of us. No one has ever heard of ammonium chloride, but that's a frequently cited trade good, and it was used as a flux for metal and also for tanning leather.
Goodness, there's some very advanced bits and pieces going up and down the Silk Road, even in those days. Do you think clearly it's an obvious statement that this route shaped the modern world, didn't it?
I think that's true. I mean, in the sense that movement across Eurasia started very early. Some people think maybe 20,000 BC and continues even now. And of course, there's been both sides of Eurasia, the Chinese side and the European side, have benefited from cross-fertilization. So in that sense, yes, it's absolutely been crucial. It's also been displaced sometimes. I think that ocean trade basically takes over, and it's so much cheaper than overland trade that if people can go by sea, they almost always opt to do so. Even very early on, like 400 AD, we have records of monks who choose to take a boat rather than to go back to China overland.
And today it's cargo freighters and sea freighters that are carrying the majority of goods from one side of the world to the other. But in your research and in your travels to that part of the world, do you still see a lot of evidence that this is a part of the world where there is still a great deal of trade taking place?
Nowadays, I actually am on the side of people who see minimal trade on the Silk Road, and I think what we see in local markets in northwestern China and Xinjiang is very representative of what there was before. The vast majority of goods are locally made, and most people are going to market and buying food or local handicrafts. The only things that are traveling long distance are small and light, like precious jewels. Silk is important because silk was used as money. It was an alternative to money, and the Chinese state supported its use because there was a shortage of coins. And silk held its value pretty well and was fairly light. It was lighter than coins. So the Tang Dynasty ships its payments to its troops by shipping bolts of silk to the Northwest and not shipping coins.
And can I just ask you finally, Professor, about your personal interest in the Silk Road? What in particular led you to become so interested in it and to write this book?
Well, this is a very historian's answer, that the Silk Road, because of the dry conditions there, it preserves all kinds of materials that don't survive in other places. And, I mean, famously, human corpses, human hair, textiles, but also paper documents. And I was drawn because those documents allow us to see moments where people encounter each other. And we have nothing like that comparable in the entire written record for China. So it was the documents, the preserved documents, that drew me to the subject.
Fascinating indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Valerie Hansen, Professor of History at Yale University, and as I said, the author of The Silk Road, which has just been published. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back right after this to find out why India is hungry for emus. But first, let's get some music. And here is something else in the Friday spirit. This is Robin with Dancing on My Own. And that was Robin with Dancing on My Own, which our producer Hannah tells us gets her in the mood for a Friday, which begs the question, conjures up images of Hannah dancing around her bedroom, dancing on her own, getting ready for her big Friday night out. And I think she might be about to kill me after this. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London, and New York.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. It is 22:45 in Tashkent. We were just speaking about the Silk Road there. 18:45 here in London, 13:45 in New York City. Now, it's a long way to fly from Australia to India, and a particularly long way if you're a flightless bird. But even so, Australia's national bird, the emu, is now in India in large numbers. This is entrepreneurial farmers trying to build an industry around them and hoping to make big business out of their rather tasty meat. Well, Monocle's New Delhi correspondent, Arti Bettigeri, has more on that.
On the outskirts of New Delhi, in the shadow of high-rise apartment construction and surrounded by rice paddy fields, is Delhi Emu Farms.
Please come, let's go inside the emu enclosure. Please come.
It's just a couple of acres in size, and home to around 300 of the tall, flashless birds, which are native to Australia. Delhi Emu Farms is one of roughly 6,500 such enterprises across India, with tens of thousands of birds. The industry is concentrated in the south, primarily the state of Andhra Pradesh, but there are more and more farms cropping up in the north as well.
As far as emus is concerned, I have found that it can sustain up to 55 degrees in summer and minus 5 degrees in winters. So that kind of climate was very suitable in Delhi for emu breeding and emu farming.
Akash Angral owns and runs Delhi Emu Farms along with his wife.
I see a lot of potential because India has a very good leather industry also, and emu skin can be used for leather, emu feather can be used for a lot of fashion accessories and fashion industries. Nails are also usable, oil is also usable, and meat of course is fat-free, cholesterol-free meat. It will be liked. It takes time for new people to accept new meats.
This farm is one of just a few that is actually slaughtering the birds. The industry is less than 5 years old. And while there are a lot of farms and a lot of emus, as yet there's really no market to speak of. Still, thousands of people have been enticed by the apparent easy returns of investing in emu eggs and chicks, and in recent weeks it became clear that many investors were duped into a kind of Ponzi scheme, where they were promised high returns for an initial investment.
The whole thing is something on the basis of a network marketing. The catch is here, the network marketing works as long as the market expands. The moment market doesn't expand, doesn't even contract, the whole thing collapses. So the Ponzi scheme happened in Tamil Nadu, and it quickly got the industry a bad name.
Surya Kumar is the head of the Delhi chapter of the National Bank for Agriculture and Rural Development, which issues loans and grants to companies setting up rural enterprises.
Many birds were left uncared for in Tamil Nadu. They claim, as per one version, people in Tamil Nadu who expected quick money very fast have lost 3 billion Indian rupees. So through the Ponzi schemes. Once the person who said they would give maintenance of 6,000 rupees every month stopped giving the money, these people didn't know what to do with the birds, because they were eating 500 to 600 grams of food every day, each bird. So they left them uncared for. And some of them obviously got starved and died.
The state government of Tamil Nadu quickly stepped in to feed the birds, allocating in the region of 10 million rupees to do this. They've since announced they will auction the birds off. The effect of the controversy was that the emu bubble well and truly burst.
This is a typical chicken and egg issue. Whether the industry should come and then the farm should grow, or you have so many farms and then a processing industry. Obviously, many farms have come, and very recently a very high-tech abattoir came near Hyderabad. That should change things for the industry. People also thought this meat is red meat, but at the same time much more healthy. But then people still have to develop a taste for this particular meat.
The industry might be predicated on the assumption that Indians will embrace emu meat as a viable alternative to red meat, but India remains a deeply vegetarian country, and even the idea of slaughtering birds is difficult to grasp for many farmers. Here's Akash Angral again.
Somebody has to take, you know, bull by the horns and start getting with the business, because it is primarily meat business. Somebody just started this business thinking that, okay, I can only trade eggs and I don't have to get my hands dirty. It is a dirty business, meat business, so one has to stain his hands.
Delhi Emu Farms currently supplies meat to between 20 and 30 private customers each week and about 5 restaurants in the city. One of these is The Rose, a new French-run hotel and restaurant in the hip neighbourhood of Housecast Village. Proprietor Francois Servant says emu has been on the menu for about 3 months and has already proven popular.
The test is between chicken and beef. It's a very interesting meat, very low in cholesterol. It's not a greasy meat at all. The cooking is very quick. When you're preparing a fillet, you just go for 40 seconds and 40 seconds on each side. It's really tasty. There is two ways of preparing it here in at the Rose. Fillet, basic fillet, with ratatouille or with French fries on the side. And the other way is that we have created lasagna, imu lasagna. They are very, very, very happy, like I was saying to you. You know, they really enjoy it. You know, when you eat fillet with a good salad, you know, it's really a top. Well, of course we will continue. You know, as far as people are happy and as far as we can propose, you know, a very healthy product, I mean, of course we will go on. Yeah.
It's an encouraging sign, but for Emu to find a true market means middle-class Indians must embrace it and incorporate it into their everyday meals. With any luck, the next time you visit India, you might find butter emu or emu sagwala on the menu. For Monocle in New Delhi, I'm Aashi Beshagiri.
Emu lasagna, something I haven't had yet, but we're going to go from emus to cats because here's Cat Power with Manhattan. And that was Manhattan by Cat Power. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, every week we like to wander around Marylebone and visit our neighbours. Well, this week we went to visit a new gallery that's just opened in nearby Manchester Street. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, spoke with the co-directors of the Room Gallery. They were Sandy McRae and Aideen Morgan.
I'm Sandy McRae, and I'm the director, one of the directors of Room Art Space, which is in Manchester Street.
And I'm Aideen Morgan, and I'm another of the directors of Room Art Space. We have only just opened. Today is really our first day. Yesterday evening, we had a preview party, which opened the event, which was wonderful. Many, many people, we think about 400 people, came to the event. It was a big success.
The Room was in Hoxton for 5 years, and before that it was in Bristol for 5 years. So we've been going for 10 years. Basically, there's 8 rooms in this property that we're occupying. There are 6 installations in 6 rooms, and then the office space is also a showroom where we exhibit works, wall-based works, and we sell things from the office.
It's a wonderful building. It's a Georgian mansion, and we opened the door on a completely dilapidated space, which we're very lucky to have for a period of time. It's really has not been lived in for quite some time, so the fabric of the building is a bit decayed. And what's happened is that we've given the opportunity to artists to come in here and respond to the building, add to it, transform it, and the results are very interesting.
Rhythmically as the dolly moved, producing a slight breathing movement in the camera. I tried to use this to hold the dolly back and put more pressure on the wires.
Marylebone's great. Mm. It's first of all, it's wonderful position, middle of London, and it looks great. Lots of Georgian housing, fantastic. Really nice to have the Wallace collection down the road in Manchester Street, and also just everywhere, wonderful shopping. It's beautiful.
Yes, it has a village atmosphere. I think that's what attracts people to this area, is that it has its identity and it's quite villagey. And you can find everything here and sort of lots of really interesting little shops and bigger shops and galleries, and it's just has a lot to offer and it's great to be here.
And there we were, meeting our neighbours Sandy McRae and Aideen Morgan, who are the co-directors of Room Gallery. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. Our thanks to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Sam Impey, and our intern was A.K. Peracorpi. Well, up next after the news is this week's episode of The Menu, and they'll be taking you to an Oktoberfest with a bit of a difference. It's in a sleepy hilltop town in the West Bank, of all places.
Taiba beer is special because it has been gathering more people of diverse backgrounds and diverse faiths than any conference or any meeting that has happened in the Middle East.
All of that still to come. Thank you very much for listening. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24.